Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Look around your office, turn on the TV. Incompetent leadership is everywhere, and there's no denying that most of those leaders are men. Why is that? If so many men make lousy bosses and political leaders, why are they so good at obtaining those positions? In his book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It, Tomas Chamorro Premusic looks at decades of research that point to the qualities that result in poor leadership, why we favor those qualities, and why elevating more women to leadership positions could be an effective way to solve some of the global leadership crises. He is the chief talent scientist at Manpower Group, a professor of business psychology at University College London and at Columbia University, as well as an associate at Harvard's Entrepreneurial Finance Lab. His book is published by Harvard Business Review Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Tomas Chamorro Premusic to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you.
I hope I got your name right.
Better than 95% of people, I would say.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, in the center of the city.
In the Villa Freud, or the I guess it's Via Freud. That's an area that has a high concentration of psychotherapists. Did that determine where you might go in your life?
I think so. It's inevitable, you know. And I would say we have the highest concentration of psychoanalysts in the world. And that keeps on growing, because if you want to be a psychoanalyst, you have to be in psychoanalysis yourself. So it's almost like a pyramid scheme, you know. It keeps on kind of multiplying and multiplying in Paris. So when I was growing up, our dog had a shrink, who obviously was treating our problems, not the dogs. The dog seemed very embarrassed, and so everyone around you was a therapist, and that's how I thought, okay, if I'm going to study something, I'm going to do that.
I assume you're too young to have been born when Perón was in power.
Yeah, he had already gone. His second wife was still alive. But mostly my early years were, during the end of the military dictatorship. And then I had the beginning of democracy, which was very ineffective. So I saw different forms of incompetent leaders. They changed the ideology, but the level of incompetence was always very high.
And you have said that looking at the support for dictatorships, you asked, how can smart and educated people make self-destructive leadership choices term after term?
Exactly. Because when we look at bad leaders in business or in organizations, you can't really blame employees. Those leaders are chosen by other leaders who might not be very good themselves. But in democracies, people vote with the best of their intentions and they want to prosper. And yet they are fooled or tricked by leaders who are not as good as they seem to be.
You're a leadership psychologist. Was that already an existing field of study when you went into it?
Very, very small. I think I got lucky in a way, because I started to study personality. And when you look at the main areas of application, historically it had been clinical, then educational. When I started doing my PhD 20 years ago, organizations were really, really going for a more data-driven approach to pick their leaders. So I got a lot of data on their personality, on gender, and on how effective these leaders were. And this is how I really got into this area.
The focus of your book is on bad leadership. But before we get to what makes a leader bad, let's talk a bit about what's at stake. What are the economic consequences of bad leadership?
Well, they are huge. We know that in organizations, and maybe we can leave political leadership aside for now, but in organizations...
It's going to be a subtext to this conversation, whether we want it to be or not.
Yes, exactly. But even if we look at organizations, we know that most employees have very negative experiences of their leaders. Typically, when we discuss leadership, we see it as a glamorous career destination, something that everybody should try to do. But actually, most people hate or at least dislike their bosses. You only have to Google "my boss is" to see what people think of their direct line managers.
You say that 75% of the people who quit their jobs do it because they don't like their direct manager, and that 65% of Americans would rather get a new boss than a raise. But the economic consequence is lost productivity as a result of all of this?
Lost productivity. For example, in the U.S., disengagement is very, very prevalent, almost ubiquitous. About 30% of people are classified as engaged, which means they like their jobs, they're enthusiastic, they're driven, and 70% are not. And most of that is caused by people's managers. In the US, it has been estimated that disengagement costs the economy $550 billion a year in productivity loss.
Wow. That could build a lot of fences. Since men have been the leaders in most societies throughout history, should we be surprised that a fair number of them have been incompetent?
We shouldn't. And of course, much like quantity leads to quality, eventually, there is a lot of waste and a lot of incompetence that is generated just through sheer numbers. I think what we need to understand is that the issue here is that, broadly speaking, there aren't enough qualified or competent men to occupy these leadership positions. So even if you just go for a more leveled ratio without actually working out what potential or talent people have, you're going to improve things.
Does it matter whether the leader is male or female? I can say from personal experience that female bosses can be just as narcissistic and be as lacking in empathy as male bosses.
Actually, they can, of course, but on average...
Well, maybe I just picked the wrong ones.
Well, you know, there are, first of all, we need to understand that the anecdotes are not as relevant here as large-scale studies, right? The plural of anecdote is not data. It's several anecdotes. There are average or general mean differences that favor women on things like empathy, emotional intelligence, pro-social behaviors, self-awareness, integrity, self-control, and there are average mean differences that, in inverted commas, favor men on toxic traits like narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. That doesn't mean that you can't meet a woman who is more narcissistic. Mm-hmm. So people are taller in Germany than in Argentina, but we can all find some Argentines that are taller than some Germans. So these are average differences. I'm not making this a categorical generalization.
And we'll get to all of those things that you mentioned as we continue this conversation. In exploring why so many incompetent men become leaders, you say that confidence is often disguised as competence.
This is probably
You give the example of a couple of Shilpa and Ryan, two colleagues in a global accounting firm.
Yes. This is probably the main factor that is at stake, especially in North America. But in general, everywhere, I think competence has become so hard to judge directly through short-term interactions. For example, we are now talking here for the first time, and you're looking at me, and you don't really know how much I know about this. So it's
I've seen your book, so
well,
I've read your book.
Thank you.
So I have a pretty good idea.
But imagine if you hadn't studied my work, right? Mm-hmm. You would then rely on whether I feel I seem assertive, whether I'm making eye contact, and ironically, if I were actually inept, I would be unaware of my limitations, and therefore I would seem or come across as more confident. So this is actually one of the main explanations of how confidence became adaptive, because if you have fooled yourself, you're going to be much better at fooling others. So ironically, sometimes we reward people who have confidence rather than competence. And we also know that people who are competent will develop a healthy degree of insecurity or at least self-criticism. So you might dismiss them because they seem weak.
So let's talk about Shilpa and Ryan. How did they differ in terms of confidence and competence?
Yeah, and so these are two imaginary characters.
Mm-hmm. How did you come up with the name Shilpa?
Well, I kept the initials of the real people, mm-hmm. and then I just looked at whatever came to my mind. But Shilpa is low-key, she doesn't talk much, she produces a lot, she lets her achievements speak for herself, and people assume that, she's not leaning in. She probably doesn't want to be a leader, and she's good where she is. So she's a solid, collaborative team performer. On the other hand, Ryan spends much less time doing his work and more time advertising himself, promoting himself, managing up, and taking credits for Shilpa's achievements.
So he's perceived as the smarter, more strategic asset to the firm. And I'm assuming he's also more likely to ask for a raise and a promotion.
Correct. And it's true that if you don't ask, you don't get. But really, we shouldn't demand that people promote themselves or put themselves forward for something in order to conclude that they're good. In an age where there is ubiquitous data to evaluate people's performance, actually, it shouldn't be a requirement to blow your own trumpet.
And following up on that, are highly confident people able to assess their strengths and weaknesses accurately?
Mostly not. I mean, in general, there is an optimism bias whereby most of us think of ourselves as better than we actually are. So most of us think of ourselves as better drivers, better lovers, better musicians, better leaders. 90% of people in any organization think they are part of the top 10 performance group. But the more confident you are, the more deceived you will be about your talents and the less you will know what you don't know.
Do people, recruiters and voters, favor confidence over competence?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, most people think that they can trust their intuition when making judgments and decisions on others, right? So most of us love our intuition, but most of us are not as intuitive as we think. So recruiters, managers, leaders, even HR professionals rely on short-term interactions with others, interviews. After 5 or 10 minutes, they decide whether they like someone or not.
So the assertive person is much more likely to make an impression.
Correct. And then they also rely on those same signals 6 months later or 12 months later to decide whether the person is performing well or not. So something that was a bias at time one replicates at time two and conveys the illusion that you were actually good at predicting that performance. I liked you in the beginning and I still like you later, but I don't check if you're actually doing your job.
You write that confidence has two sides, internal and external.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, you know, the internal one is the one that really we should care about the most. So imagine that you are deciding whether you should cross a busy road, an avenue, right? It would help to know whether you have time to cross before the cars or the buses come. So what's the best degree of confidence? Not the highest possible, which would mean you just jump and cross and get hit or run over by a car, but the one that actually aligns with your actual competence. So the goal there of the internal confidence is to tell you whether you're good at something or not. That said, others are looking for indicators or signals of how confident we are. And when people say, oh, just fake it till you make it, well, it obviously helps to come across as confident to others, because they would assume, okay, this guy or this girl seems to be really good. They seem to have no insecurities, no self-doubt. They probably know what they're talking about.
And you mentioned narcissism and psychopathy earlier. Are they more common among men who are terrible leaders?
They're more common in men, full stop. Although with regards to narcissism, the differences or the gap is decreasing. Women today are more narcissistic than they were 15, 20, 30 years ago. But we also know that these two traits are more common in leaders than the overall population.
Anybody figure out why women are becoming more narcissistic?
Well, I think it has to, if you look at
changing roles in
changing
our society.
Roles, you know, culture expects women to be more feminine today in industrialized nations, where I think the assumption that is being made is that women need to emulate men in order to be as successful. But what we don't think about is that the individual level that women or men may attain isn't necessarily good for others. So I would argue actually that we could ask or should ask men to be less confident and more feminine, and then they would actually produce something better or deliver something better for others.
What are some of the symptoms or indications of a narcissistic leader?
Narcissistic leaders tend to be entitled. They are very self-absorbed and self-focused. They don't accept any mistakes. They get very aggressive and defensive when criticized. They want to be the center of attention. They have an inability to empathize with others or connect with others. And they spend a long time managing their appearance, their reputation, and it's all about them. So when they are leaders, you can't expect them to care more about their teams and subordinates than they do about themselves.
Don't a lot of people find those qualities attractive in leaders? It's become a major topic on talk shows these days.
And no doubt we are living in a narcissistic culture. Look at our role models, right? Look at the success of Kim and Kanye. I think we've always admired people who are famous, but our admiration for people who admire themselves or are famous for being famous has been rising. By the way, if we continue like this, in 50 years' time, we would look back to this day, 2019, and think that, wow, Justin Bieber, Kim Kardashian, Kanye West, they were really modest and low-key individuals compared to what we will have in 50 years' time.
Oh, boy. I guess I should be grateful I won't be alive at that time. I'm speaking to Tomas Chamorro Premusic about his what he's written about in his book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Why are narcissists more likely to become leaders?
I think there is still the issue at stake that when somebody is unaware of their limitations or unjustifiably pleased with themselves, we admire them and we gravitate towards them. Freud actually made this point 100 years ago. He said, people want a leader so that they can relinquish or give up their own level of narcissism and love somebody who is powerful and will love them back. And when that person is very narcissistic, it's even more likely that we will be drawn towards them. Narcissists have great visions. They tell us that they're going to change the world, make our future brighter, and all these things. So we are drawn to this level because it taps into our own narcissism. If you're going to tell me that you're going to make me successful, rich, great, I will love you, and I will expect you to love me back, even if it's a delusion.
But not everybody is drawn to it. Some of us are turned off by what we perceive as narcissism. What does that say about us?
Well, it's certainly more rational to try to evaluate what a leader actually proposes, what he or she can do. And even when we look at the impact that charisma has on people's preferences for leadership, kind of leaders or leadership profiles, we glorify charisma, but it's an emotional vehicle of influence. In a logical world, it shouldn't matter whether somebody is magnetic, whether somebody has great charm, because what matters is how competent the person is and whether they have the right intentions or not.
Has anybody looked at past American presidents to determine if they had narcissistic tendencies?
Yes, there are a couple of studies that are, you know, academic journal articles where people took different biographical records of past presidents and sort of indexed those traits and the words they said in speeches, you know, the degree to which they sought notoriety and featured in the media, etc. And comparing them to the overall population, they found that on average, American presidents tend to be much higher on narcissism than the overall population, which makes sense. Sort of. I mean, who else would want to run for president? You have to be think pretty highly of yourself. And to actually persist and achieve it, you know, clearly there can't be much self-doubt there.
So are there beneficial sides to some aspects of narcissism? After all, we've had some highly effective presidents. Should I assume that Lincoln, both of the Roosevelts, some of the others who we consider among the greats,
were less narcissistic?
Or more narcissistic?
I would say less. I think in general, since in the 1960s, you know, the turning point, I think, is when JFK beats Nixon in the first major televised debate because Nixon is sweating, in effect. Then the televisual age starts, and today social media age is the same. I mean, the best predictor of whether people vote for someone or not is whether you want to have a beer with that person or not, which will never happen. But we just make these inferences based on how people present, what their style is, and we pay very little attention to substance.
Well, it's been said that JFK had more charisma than Richard Nixon. On the other hand, Richard Nixon did wind up becoming a twice-elected president.
Correct. And I think that charisma is neither good nor bad in itself. It's an amplifier. If you have a leader with great levels of competence and good integrity, charisma will be very helpful because it will help that leader influence people and help them operate like a team and achieve a goal. But if that leader has no competence or no integrity, then charisma will make him or her much more lethal. Mao, Hitler, and Stalin would have been a lot less detrimental to the world had they had no charisma.
You write that charisma exists in the eye of the beholder only. So that means that the charisma isn't universally perceived, and the leaders you mentioned weren't admired by everybody. But how does it differ from narcissism and psychopathy?
Well, charisma is just an attribute that people see or assign to a leader. A lot of work has looked at what predicts whether somebody is seen as charismatic. And you're absolutely right. It's in the eye of the beholder, but in a way it's in the eye of the we holder, because there are collective attributions that mean that people do agree, much like they agree on whether someone is attractive or not. And it's when people are attractive, when people are tall, when people are brave, when they seem confident, when they are articulate, and when they are powerful, we are more likely to say, wow, this person is charismatic.
So if we believe that a leader has charisma, are we more apt to overlook their flaws?
Absolutely. You tolerate their flaws much more. This is one of the main dangers of electing politicians or having leaders who are charismatic, because then we focus just on their style and not much on their substance. And we sort of want them to keep in being in power so they entertain us. And we're less likely to focus on whether they're actually doing a good job or not.
Until recently, I would assume that most people only thought of women as being charismatic when they were movie stars. But now it's become an issue during this upcoming presidential campaign. Who has more charisma?
Yes, and I think I find it hard to believe that in the near future, any candidate will be able to win or get far in a presidential election in the U.S. If they're not charismatic, because they have to be in the media all the time and they have to be judged based on their interactions. You know, the politicians today are entertainers. They are celebrities. At the same time,
TV has made them that, and the internet.
It has, you know, but at the same time, we have examples, right? We have examples. In Germany, when people vote, a lot of voters go to a website, they answer a survey with 50 questions that is designed to explore their attitudes towards health, the economy, labor laws, the environment. And once you finish that survey, it tells you, you will vote for this person because they are actually representing your attitudes. Can you imagine that happening in America?
Well, that's led to Angela Merkel, but now a growth in neo-fascism in Germany. So what does that wind up revealing?
Well, there has been a growth of neo-fascism in
all throughout Europe,
and the world, I would say, you know, and the world. And I think in Germany, it is a reaction to what Merkel has done. But at the same time, if we evaluate all heads of states in the last 10 or 15 years, you will not find a single president, prime minister, or head of state that has been so successful, so pragmatic, so not ideological, and at the same time, so boring. As I always say, there will be no movies on Angela Merkel because there are no scandals, and this is a rational person who puts the country first and is trying to make competent decisions.
You write that organizations would be well advised to hire people with moderate amounts of charisma. Well, how can you measure something like that?
I mean, you can measure it. The best way to measure it would be to just get 5 or 10 people to rate different candidates. And even with 5 people, you will get ratings that predict how they will be seen by thousands or even millions of people. There are also personality traits that predict whether somebody is charismatic or not. We talked about the dark side traits or toxic traits like psychopathy and narcissism, but there are also positive traits, emotional intelligence, extroversion, high degree of adjustment or emotional stability. And then there are things like attractiveness, which we don't like to accept, but it's a big, big marker or predictor of whether somebody's seen as charismatic or not.
Is it possible for a job recruiter or the electorate to identify narcissism in a candidate?
You can't identify it with 100% degree of accuracy, but if you had psychological assessments, you mine their past performance data, you ask people who know that person and who have worked with that person closely. So, for example, in organizations, one of the most valuable tools to do this is what we call 360-degree feedback. So, especially how employees rate their bosses. There's a lot of information there that will tell you with a high degree of probability whether somebody is narcissistic or not.
You ask an intriguing question in your book, why do we love psychopaths?
Indeed. And, you know, and I want to make it clear that we have to think about these, even though they have kind of a shocking and negative connotation, we have to think about these traits, psychopathy, narcissism, as ordinal or quantitative. So people differ in degrees on these traits, much like they differ in height, weight. You know, we like to call people smart, dumb, fat, thin, interesting, boring, but actually there are degrees. And what we know is that there is a very thin line or gray zone between normality and abnormality. Narcissism and psychopathy is an example. So if you think about psychopathy as a trait, it ranges from, on the one end, people who are very altruistic, very prosocial, so worried about others that they're selfless and constantly trying to make a good impression. On the other hand, you have people who are antisocial, reckless, sensation seekers, and they are destructive because all they want is to achieve their own selfish benefits or goals.
In his book, Snakes in Suits, Professor Robert Hare writes, "Not all psychopaths are in prison, some are in the boardroom." And I'm assuming many are in government as well.
Yes, and I think it's the ones that are not that smart that tend to get caught. So when we study, you know, prisoners or inmates, they're basically psychopathic individuals or individuals with psychopathic tendencies, but they're not as socially skilled or streetwise. We mostly like psychopathic individuals because we respect and glorify risk-taking, being brave, being fearless. And a lot of the times, psychopaths have charisma and are charming. You don't have to think about extreme cases of, criminals, but people sometimes that we don't even think are psychopathic figures from fiction, like James Bond is a very, very good example or archetype of a psychopathic individual.
Although I'm told that he is not like any real spy, that real spies are very introverted. Is it true that there are three times more psychopaths in management than in the general population? But how did anyone come up with that figure?
That's a conservative estimate, right? and you're right to question it. Some people have said 5, 10, 20. It's hard to extrapolate from the studies where we have data, because in most organizations, people don't assess their leaders' levels of psychopathy. But that estimate is based on clinical levels of psychopathy, which is shocking. In the overall population, it's only 1%. It's estimated that in management and the corporate world and in leaders, it's as high as 4 or 5%.
What are the consequences of putting psychopaths in leadership positions?
I mean, you know, the upside will be that they can be entertaining, charming, entrepreneurial, have a tendency to make adventurous and risky decisions. But on the downside, they will have very little consideration for others. They will manipulate others and take advantage of them. And they will generally be very antisocial. Now, you don't have to be an expert on the subject to realize that even some of the most successful entrepreneurs, self-made billionaires, display psychopathic tendencies because they were quite unemployable to begin with. They are very nonconformist. They can't follow orders and they have a problem with authority. And they're trying to destroy the status quo, often to replace it with something good. So the successful ones might become self-made billionaires and entrepreneurs, and the unsuccessful ones we imprison.
But you say that they tend to have an inability to build and motivate team members and an unwillingness to accept blame and responsibility. They have a lack of follow-through and impulsive unpredictability. There's a new book by a psychologist, Lori Helgo, that calls narcissists fragile bullies.
Well, and that's a very interesting, assertion. There are broadly two types of narcissists. there are we have the insecure or neurotic narcissists who would be fragile because they need to belittle others and bring them down so that they can, you know, raise their own self-esteem levels. And equally, they're constantly looking for validation. Social media has created a narcissistic ecosystem where I need to post stuff all the time so that you like me. And if you don't like my activity, you know, I can be depressed.
So people who post more selfies are more likely to be narcissistic?
Correct. And social media activity is a good way to track or monitor or even infer people's level of narcissism. On the other hand, you have the psychotic or deluded narcissist who is not insecure. They are just megalomaniacs and they have very, very high unrealistic levels of self-esteem or self-concept. And they sort of replace reality with a deluded fantasy version of themselves. They are their own hero.
Although, as we've seen in a number of instances in Washington recently, like Devin, what's his name now? Suddenly, I've forgotten it. His lawsuit because he felt so thin-skinned about people criticizing him.
Yes, and again, you know, I think to some degree we expect people to fight back and be defensive and be aggressive when people get criticized, when in fact a more mature, rational, and unemotional response would be to try to engage with them. You can see it also, again, in social media with all the trolls that are provoking and insulting and the trolling that has become even commonplace in individuals who are reputable in power and leaders.
Tomas Chamorro Pramusic is my guest on today's Leonard Lopate at Large. His book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It, is published by Harvard Business Review Press. And you're all over the place. You got you're teaching in London and at Columbia and at Harvard?
No, the Harvard was it's an associate role where I have helped with some research and academic aspects of what used to be called the Entrepreneurial Finance Lab, which is a very, very large scale attempt to use assessment and tools to help governments and banks profile consumers and individuals on risk. So to see whether somebody, for example, is worthy of a loan or not, but using psychological assessments to predict that.
Well, obviously, you never spoke to Deutsche Bank, but you do describe Bernie Madoff as a psychopath, and it's interesting. A lot of people trusted him. That was dangerous. How can lay people spot a psychopath?
It's very hard. So it's harder to spot a psychopath than it is to spot a narcissist, even though, by the way, a lot of people are both, right? So there is some degree of comorbidity. But Madoff, I think, is a good example. And it's an easy one in a way because he, you know, kind of manufactured and engineered the biggest financial fraud in history, and he got caught, you know. But I think what you can see is this kind of fearless, megalomaniac pursuit of selfish goals and a total disregard for harming others. In some cases, you know, he was looking after the finances and the monies of people who were quite close to him. And in fact, he harmed his whole family.
And rather sophisticated people. And I'm assuming a fair number of narcissists and psychopaths and those people as well, because they were in leadership roles.
Correct. And you have to wonder,
happens when they all meet? Is there a clash?
Clearly, you know, greed is the main currency here. And you can see how greedy Madoff was, because maybe he could have stopped himself earlier, but he kept going and going and going. And that's why he got caught reporting even ridiculous growth or profits when the global economy was collapsing, which is apparently how he got caught, but then also the greed of his investors, of his clients, who were all smart and wealthy individuals, and yet they didn't quit. They trusted him beyond rationality.
In a survey, 92% of respondents couldn't name a woman who held a leadership role in tech, while 8% named Siri or Alexa.
Correct. I
don't know if that's funny or sad.
You know, it is both. I think it is funny because it exposes the ignorance that people have, and also it is sad because it exposes the level of bias that people have. You would have thought at least, you know, Sheryl Sandberg would have gotten mentioned, but not even that.
Do women have an inherent advantage when it comes to being good and competent leaders?
They over-index in a number of traits that have become particularly relevant today for two reasons. One is emotional intelligence is taking care, artificial intelligence, machine learning algorithms, computers are automating or at least complementing individuals on all the tasks that are rational, algorithmic, and to the point that the premium today is for leaders who have social skills and emotional intelligence. And the second one is that for a long time, we've been selecting people with a hyper-masculine profile, people who are abrasive, bold, fearless, risk-taking, narcissistic, and psychopathic. So the female advantage is to have more empathy, to have more altruism, to be more prosocial, to be better communicators, to have higher levels of emotional intelligence, and to be more humble. We have been saying for 20 years that leaders should be humble, but we are just paying lip service to humility. We keep on selecting arrogant leaders, and arrogance is much more common in men than women.
Although, as I mentioned earlier, and many of my listeners know, that hasn't always been the case in my own job history, but that's for another show.
Okay.
Have there ever been studies that systematically compared competence levels between men and women?
They have, and it's tricky to do this because you need to get actual performance data for the leaders that is decoupled or independent of perceptions, right? So a lot of the times we look at how employees evaluate their leaders, and then of course if employees are sexist, they're going to rate their male managers more positively than they rate their female managers.
But they're equally incompetent.
Male and female? Or, well, no.
In my experience, there have been good ones and bad ones.
There are good ones and bad ones. But if you look at the data, we know that on average, women have teams that are more engaged, slightly more engaged, that they're also more productive, that they lead in a more transformational way. They're less likely to be absent leaders. They're less likely to lead in a dictatorial way. And they're more likely to actually develop, coach their employees, and evaluate them fairly. And some people say, well, isn't that just because it's harder for women to become leaders, so therefore the ones that are there go through more scrutiny? And the answer might be yes, in which case the solution is not to make it easier for women to become leaders so that we have more incompetent female leaders, but to make it harder for incompetent men to become leaders when they shouldn't.
You've mentioned emotional intelligence during this conversation, EQ. What's the science that supports the existence of EQ?
There's a lot of science to support it. When Daniel Goleman first popularized the term 20 years ago or so with his book, which became a very famous bestseller, actually a lot of the claims were based on his intuitive remarks, and there were only 4 or 5 academic papers exploring the topic. Now we have something like 3,000, and a lot of those studies have done a very, very simple thing, which is to evaluate what the leader's level of EQ or emotional intelligence is, and to compare what impact do leaders have based on their EQ on their teams. And what you find is that leaders with higher levels of emotional intelligence tend to have teams that are more engaged, more productive, they stay with them longer, they're less likely to quit. They can even pay their employees less, and they would still want to work for them compared to leaders who have low emotional intelligence, who will be, you know, very excitable, grumpy, unpredictable, and hard to please.
Do women tend to have higher EQs?
Yes, and the difference is small. You know, it's to put it into perspective, the height difference between men and women is about twice as large on average as the difference in EQ favoring women, right? So it's a small difference. But if on top of that, you look at also empathy, self-awareness, humility, and altruism, then you're getting to differences favoring women that are comparable, if not bigger, than the height difference that favors men.
Is this something that that people who are doing hiring are aware of? Do organizations actively recruit leaders with high EQs?
More and more do. It's still a minority, I would say. The majority of organizations don't even use predictive assessment tools or data to actually screen or profile their leaders. But emotional intelligence is a rare case where organizations are following the science, because they know that to have good soft skills, people skills, and basically being able to control yourself, not just manage others, is critical. This is especially obvious in the hashtag MeToo age, which has harmed organizations, because it's no longer okay for leaders to bully, harass, and misbehave. The reputational damage is very big. If you get people with EQ, that's less likely to happen.
Is there any link between EQ and IQ?
Zero. The correlation is zero. So we might all be able to think of people with high IQ and low EQs, especially if they're super smart. But at the same time, the reverse is often the case. People who are very streetwise, but academically not very smart. But we tend to remember people who are unusual, who are the exception to the rule. In most instances, your EQ can't predict your IQ and vice versa.
How does one identify a person with a high EQ in a job interview?
The best way is to avoid interviewing them altogether and just give them a scientifically validated assessment, so a scientifically derived assessment. And really what you're looking at is basically, is this person emotionally stable? Can they manage themselves? Are they self-centered or not? Do they have empathy? Are they able to identify other people's emotions? And do they care about other people's emotions? And really, a lot of what EQ really evaluates is whether a person will be rewarding to deal with, right? So if you've worked with people for a few years, you know whether somebody is obnoxious, difficult, or whether they're the other extreme. The other extreme means high EQ. I think there is that very nice Oscar Wilde quote that says, some people cause happiness wherever they go, others whenever they go. And so the former are high EQ, the latter are low EQ individuals.
You say that the characteristics of a good leader are intellectual capital, social capital, and psychological capital. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, and these are the
intellectual capital. Is that another way of saying leaders should be smart?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, these are the three buckets. But a better way is to say, okay, intellectual capital is what the leader knows. Okay, so what is the expertise, the experience? Even in today's world where technical expertise and knowledge has been devalued because it's changing all the time, and what you are likely to learn matters more than what you already know, you still want your leaders to have technical expertise. If not, they're going to have no credibility. I couldn't be a leader in the technology sector or in the engineering world or in the legal world or the finance world because I have no clue about the technical stuff. That is necessary but not sufficient. On top of that, you have psychological capital, which includes intelligence and learning ability, how fast a person will adapt to new environments and solve complex, you know, learning problems. And then personality. Will they have people skills? Will they be able to manage themselves and others? Will they have integrity? Will they be honest? Will they be humble? And finally, there's social capital, which is often neglected, but it matters what your network is. Who you know is always as important as what you know. And this is where we get into the uncomfortable conversation of social mobility and inherited wealth, privilege, and status.
And good leaders need to influence people and sway them to do things.
Yes, and that's really the important reminder here is that we should judge a leader's performance based on how he or she affects the team. Good leaders turn a group of B players into an A team. Bad leaders turn a group of A players into a B team. Good leaders persuade individuals to set aside their selfish agendas to achieve something as a collective unit. So fundamentally, leadership is a psychological resource that enables people to work together to achieve something they couldn't achieve individually.
You would see that with the manager of a sports team.
Correct.
And the world because some really get everybody to pull together and others don't know how to do that.
Yeah, and I love the sport analogy because on the one hand, things are a lot clearer. There are clear rules of the game. You can look at where teams are doing in the table, whether they, you know, even relative to the money they spend, are they doing well or not. On the other hand, it's still not rocket science. You know, people still have debates as to whether if a team did well with a new manager, is that because of the work that the previous manager did, the foundations or not? And in the world of organizations, civil jobs is a lot more complicated because the rules of the games are not clearly defined. We don't have that much. Well, people are not spending 90% of the time training. And the level of talent that most people have in an average organization is average. You don't have exceptional athletes.
But you say that when recruiting leaders, potential is more important than talent.
Yes, and what does this actually mean? Well, talent is means being a star performer, right? If I evaluate you in the context of your organization, I would call you talent or top talented individual if you're a star contributor, if you're part of the 20% of that group that contributes 80% of the productivity. Potential is talent before it's there. So it's nascent talent or talent before it happens. And it turns out that most organizations simply promote people who perform well as individual contributors onto leadership role, which doesn't make any sense. You move them away from a task they're good at to give them a task they are maybe not good at and not interested in doing. So when we evaluate whether somebody should be promoted from employee to manager or manager to leader, we should look at whether they have these soft skills, psychological capital that we just described.
Somebody once said that people rise to the level of incompetence.
Absolutely, the Peter principle, and I think it's correct. If you've been long enough in an organization that you stagnated, your potential is where you are minus one role, because if you're no longer worthy of promotion, you shouldn't have been promoted to where you are.
So we've laid out the problems. How do we learn to distrust our current tendency to value confidence, charisma, and charisma, however we apply that?
So I think if we wanted to improve the state of affairs or the status quo, and you know, I like to remind people that the book is titled "Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders?" and "How to Fix It." So the second part does provide some solutions.
And we only have a few minutes to come up with those solutions.
Well, so firstly, we need to follow the science and look for the traits or qualities that make people better leaders, especially when they don't usually make them leaders. Competence instead of confidence, humility instead of charisma, and integrity instead of narcissism. Secondly, we need to distrust our instincts and follow data-driven tools, predictive assessments, etc. And thirdly, if we want to increase the number of female leaders, we should follow the same approach we would if we wanted to improve the quality of the leaders, which is not make it easier for women to become leaders, but make it harder for men who aren't competent to become leaders.
Why do you think, I remember during the last election, a number of women said that they didn't trust a woman in a leadership role?
They're living in the same culture, they're in the same environment, and women can be as sexist or chauvinistic even as men, although on average, you know, chauvinism is more common in men because, you know, they reap the benefits, whereas women, you know, hardly ever do.
You describe some of the ways to measure talent signals, which includes web scraping and gamification?
Mm-hmm. So in the old days, you had things like interviews and assessment, looking at internal performance data. Technology and AI have provided us with a new range of tools. We all have given away so much data, personal data, that could be translated into an accurate estimate of our potential, that I think in the future, algorithms will stitch this data together. And even looking at your Amazon history, your Netflix and Spotify preferences, your credit card statement, what you say on WhatsApp, Facebook, Twitter, I will be able to know whether you are more or less narcissistic, more or less competent, more or less smart.
Although we just recently did a show on algorithms, and they can be misleading as well.
For sure.
As we depend on them more and more, we're more likely to
Correct.
Be misled.
True, but we are more critical when we evaluate bias in algorithm than bias in humans.
Let's say you have a bad boss or a bad political leader. Is it reasonable to expect them to improve?
I would say that for 30% of incompetent leaders, whether they are in business or politics, we can expect improvements of about 30%, right? So you can't
well,
turn
that's
somebody.
A lot.
It's not bad, and the key is that they actually want to change, which requires self-awareness and which requires them to be somewhat coachable. Then they also need to have the right level and type of advice and help and support.
Do leadership qualities vary across cultures?
They do somewhat. So the generic traits or foundational competencies that make people good leaders are always the same. You always want leaders with more competence, and you want them to have more integrity, more people skills, more self-awareness, and more humility. But there are degrees to which these qualities are liked more or not. So, for example, in collectivistic societies in East and Asia, humility is valued more than in the West.
Well, take a country like Venezuela. I don't want to get into which side is right or wrong, mm-hmm. but a very wealthy country is now really struggling. Mm-hmm. And there are an awful lot of people who support the leaders who put them into that position.
Correct. And I think that you can see that populist charisma still eclipses actual competence. The country I grew up in, Argentina, was one of the richest countries in the world in 1890, and the GDP at that time was higher than France and Germany. It's also the only country that has been in perpetual decline. It keeps on getting worse and worse and worse. And
even more than Brazil, which was once, at one point, Brazil was predicted to be one of the big three, the United States, China, and Brazil.
Correct. Well, Brazil has 200 million people. We have 40, but still, relative to its population, worse than Brazil. And people wonder, how is that possible? Well, one bad government after another.
Which was chosen by the people, wasn't it? Or is the process rigged to some degree?
Well, what's that Winston Churchill quote, that democracy is the worst political system except for all the others? That might be the case. I think it's just very hard today for the average voter to assess whether a politician is competent or not.
Are you a leadership coach?
I do some coaching, yes.
How do you know if a boss has the potential to improve his or her leadership skills?
Actually, I look for whether they have a minimum level of curiosity, whether they have a minimum level of self-awareness, whether they are self-critical, whether they can look at their performance data and admit that there are things to fix. So sometimes the potential clients that I'm referred don't have that minimum level of coachability, and then I say, sorry, I won't take their money. I can't work with them.
Really?
Yeah. And then a lot of the times, actually, what I do in my coaching is lower people's confidence so that it aligns with their actual level of potential or competence and they get better. You need to know that you're doing something wrong and that you're not as good as you think if you're really hoping to improve.
We mentioned earlier that there are many countries right now that have moved toward a kind of neo-fascism. In many cases, countries where fascism was a total disaster in the past. Mm-hmm. So do we have short memories, or does fascism appeal to people because they see it as implemented by strong leaders who will change things and not happy with what they have right now?
I think it's a combination of both. Still, even if we look at 200 years of history span, that's a very short time frame in the grand scheme of things. We've existed for 200,000 years or so. But I think that the main trend we're seeing now is an upsurge or a rise of populism. It can be right-wing or it can be left-wing, but the reason for this is that it's paradoxically, in the information age, it's very easy to be ignorant. And it's very easy that's what we complain or we are alarmed by fake news, etc., because people want to confirm their beliefs. And when leaders come and blame others for their problems, that has a very, very powerful and seductive effect.
The reason that some people will believe even the most outlandish conspiracies exist?
Absolutely, because it's self-enhancing, especially if it helps them not blame themselves for problems, And it's a lot of the times what people want is to have their sense of pride restored. They don't even want to improve their economic conditions, but they want to feel that they are as important as they once were.
I've been speaking with Tomas Chamorro Pramuzik. His book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It, is published by Harvard Business Review Press. It's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Tomas, to Susie Stoltz, who produced today's segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent.